the conversation of your life, local, relevant, digital, and always on.
America will hear my two cents.
Elected to serve iHub radio listeners across the desert cities. He calls it as he sees it.
Quick question.
Now, here's Russ Betts.
Someone answer him now!
All right, welcome to the Russ Betts Show here on iHub Radio in beautiful downtown Palm Springs. If you're just joining us at the top of the hour, you missed a lively first hour in which we talked extensively about the coronavirus and a little bit of griping about daylight savings time. We had to get down here an hour earlier today. But all's well, we're at the controls, coffee brewing, and here in this beautiful studio in beautiful downtown Palm Springs. And joining me is Councilmember Joe McKee, becoming a guest host on the show, I guess. Joe, it's good to have you here. Welcome.
Thanks.
And so we beat the death, the coronavirus. It's gone. You don't have to worry about it anymore. We talked about it so much that that one's solved.
If nothing else, it's bored to death.
Yeah. Well, if you want to catch the podcast, it actually was interesting, I thought. Go check the podcast out later or the rebroadcast later today. You can find us at iHubRadio.com. You can find us on your smartphone. Well, if you're listening, you already know that, but tell your friends. So now we're talking about a case that came up in Palm Springs involving former Palm Springs Mayor Steve Pugnay, John Westman, a developer, and Richard Meany, a developer, and some organization called, I think, the FBI or Department of Justice, and grand juries looking into possible allegations of public corruption. And this was one of those raids on City Hall. They took all the computers, every record they had in the place. And surprise, surprise, here's a big scandal. A mayor that was loved, a city council that seemed to be doing everything right and reviving Palm Springs. And now there's allegations that, well, something was very wrong going on, a little bit of self-dealing. So, interestingly, the grand jury transcript was released to the public. And we had a little discussion in the first hour, and Joe made a good point. Well, what are they doing, prejudicing the jury like this by releasing the transcript? And as we go through this, we're going to go dig into this a little bit and share with you. But, I mean, that was your thought during the first hour.
Well, it's more than just this, though, too. I mean, the local news media has basically flogged this one for a long time. And it's never a situation where they'll say this is an alleged thing. It's always prefaced with something like scandal in Palm Springs or something along those lines, making an assumption that the person is already guilty. And this is not unusual. It happens in almost all cases that are high profile, you know, as far as anything's concerned.
And I think the Desert Sun took a pretty sedate approach on the article, and it came out this week. They're our news partner here at iHub Radio. Good to have them with us and have their support. But they came out, and they were actually, that's where I got the link. They put up the link to all these grand jury testimony. And the point you were making is if you're going to go be on a jury that's going to hear this case,
it's going to be difficult to find one that has absolutely no knowledge of anything that's gone on so far.
And the defense attorneys for Pugnay, Westman, and Meany all said, hey, don't release that, you know, and basically agreeing with you, and I guess me, that this is very prejudicial. I know as I read through this, I'm only getting one side of the story, and that always impresses you. But so we're going to dig into this. We're going to just, you know, go a little more detail. We're going
to. I think it's better that we talk about some of the questions that were asked rather than digging into it.
All right. Well, I want to give the listeners a little flavor of how these things go. If you haven't read a grand jury transcript, it's really actually interesting. They have somebody there, a stenographer, taking down every word, and they do a really good job of it. And in this case, you know, it starts out. You do solemnly swear that the evidence you shall give in this proceeding shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God. And the witness says, I do. And the grand jury foreperson says, please be seated. Please state and spell your full name for the record. Now, when you get sent into a grand jury as a witness, that doesn't mean you're guilty. That means they're gathering evidence. You had some information relative to the case that they're investigating. And so I just want to put that caveat out there. There's a lot of people that went before that grand jury in this case, And one of them was the witness who we're going to use as an example of what went on and dig into some of this. And it's Paul Lewin, a former Palm Springs City Council member.
And you do have the same rights as in front of a grand jury that you do in any questioning situation. You can basically use your Fifth Amendment rights to say, I'm not going to answer that, too.
Yeah. And if you're the subject of a grand jury investigation, I think probably the best advice.
That's probably what you're going to do.
Yeah, and of course, everybody gets that one wrong. They say, oh, he took the Fifth Amendment. He must be guilty, and the public doesn't understand what the Fifth Amendment protection is as far as protecting your liberties of not going into self-incrimination, because anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law.
And they can actually find additional stuff, too, if you open the door. So It goes into a discussion about when you're even stopped by a policeman. What should you say? Should you allow yourself or your car to be searched in those situations? Should you answer any questions? You know, those sorts of things.
Well,
there are big discussions about this.
And going off on that tangent a little bit, hi, have you had anything to drink tonight? Well, if you say no and you have, now you're guilty of lying to a peace officer.
Yes.
If you say yes, well, now you're guilty of driving under the influence.
Well, then you immediately go to a testing situation.
Yeah, so your answer is, officer, I'm sorry, I would like to have my lawyer present at this checkpoint, and I'm
exactly.
not going to answer your question.
Exactly.
But that's a tangent. Let's get into this. So we're going to look into a little bit of what went on here with former council member Paul Lewin, the Palm Springs City Council, who served with Mayor Pugnay. And what this shows for me is they had one darn heck of a good, honest city council member in Paul Lewin. I mean, this guy was stellar. And as you go through and you see these questionings that are going on here, I mean, once you get past the introductions, what's your job, what do? You know, they get into some of the meat of it. Were you aware of the fight that was going on between Mayor Pugnay and Mr. Westman about the possible eminent domain regarding the mall? And if you've paid attention to Palm Springs, you know they had a big mall that Westman bought and was just sitting there idle for 10 years or more as a big eyesore, ugly thing. And the city wanted something more productive done with that property. It was an issue of different campaigns, people running for, you know.
And there were discussions of developers that would, on purpose, and I'm not sure in this case if this was true or not, I'm just using this as a general statement, that would buy a property and hold it until they could get a much, much better deal with the city that was involved as far as help with taxes or financing or things like that.
Yeah, and back at that time, you know, everybody's saying, oh, Palm Springs is dead. Palm Desert's the new be-all, end-all of places to be in the Coachella Valley, and they're trying to do a renaissance in Palm Springs to get its former glory back, and here's this big mall sitting there unused.
Yes.
So, of course, everybody heard about it, and so they asked about that. It's just a generally leading question to get warmed up. That's what you get when you read these transcripts. You can see the back and forth play that goes on, and they get into they ask questions of where he answers, I take my oath seriously and I didn't want to have any conflicts. And what was the responsibility of a city council member who did have a conflict? It's your responsibility to monitor your conflicts of interest and declare what they are and recuse yourself from any matters involving that. Then they ask him if he's familiar with the Form 700, and that's a form where all council members fill out where all their economic interests are. And, of course, he knew where the FPPC form was. And he said, did you receive training on conflicts of interest? And, yes, he attended the League of California Cities training.
Well, you're required to.
Yeah, and he went to Sacramento and took the training and ethics courses, and it's something you do every 2 years. And, the jury foreman says, well, it sounds like you took that very seriously. He says, yes, I did. And then they said, well, you're supposed to give the reason for your recusal. And that starts to get into the meat of Mayor Pugnay recusing from some items, but not really saying why. And I guess it was later learned that he was deriving an income. He didn't state, hi, I've got a job working for this guy, and he's paying me, upwards of $200,000 or more. I'm just going to recuse. Now, he did recuse, so, you sit there, if you're looking at the other side of this, well, what was the problem there if he did recuse? But anyhow, so you know, the guys.
That's going to be, in a lot of ways, the crux of the case, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, well, so we'll get into the transcript, you see. So I want to talk about some specific issues regards to Mr. Pernier. Were you aware of his conflict with the Palm Springs International Film Festival? And Lewin says, I was aware of it. It was surprising to me. I became aware of it as a result of reading about it in the newspaper. And as far as I can recall, that's how I heard about it. Why was it surprising to you? It's surprising to me because the city of Palm Springs is a major sponsor of the International Film Festival, and all the mayors in the past, I remember when it was started by Sonny Bono, they would serve with pleasure and help guide this thing. It's a big deal in the city. And it's the most important thing that we do in terms of the city. So yeah, I found it surprising that he would be employed by it because we're supposed to serve the city, not get paid for it. And did you learn about it from the newspaper? He did. So that's where he learned about it. He didn't learn about it from a recusal. The point is that the grand jury foreperson is asking.
I don't think the foreperson is asking this. It's a lawyer most of the time.
Well,
The jury can ask questions on their own. It is one of the differences between a regular jury and a grand jury. The jury can ask questions. But they're mostly led, the questioning is mostly led by a lawyer.
So this one says grand jury foreperson, that's how it's identified in this dialogue, it's a transcript, but whoever it is, you know, they're getting at, did the mayor properly recuse himself? I mean, they're looking for stuff. And so the answer was that he was surprised that he didn't get the explanation. And then, did you ever have any conversations with Mr. Pernier regarding Rich Meaney and his relationship with him? And yes, did he ever mention working for Mr. Meaney? Not to my recollection, no. Anything about a consulting agreement? He never said anything that I can recall about, and I don't recall anything like that. So it goes on, and it gets into one interesting subject. And this is where, you know, we get into the show where we peel back the layer of government. What's going on, and how does this stuff work? And maybe this is something you didn't know, and you... It becomes day-to-day knowledge when you're a council member working with this stuff all the time. They start talking about public improvement bonds relative to a project that had stalled in Palm Springs. And they ask, are you aware of these public improvement bonds? And what is the relation to any specific public improvement bonds? Yes, there was a vote coming up on which project. I think it was called Pedregal. And the jury foreman who's ever asked the question says, yes, Pedregal was the name we've been using, so everybody knows what you mean by that, so that's okay, you can use that. Specifically, what was the conversation about the public improvement bonds and the Pedregal project? And Lewin explains they have these bonds basically to pay for public improvements if the developer goes belly up or abandons the project. You know, at the very least, the public improvements, which are the streets, curbs, and gutters, will be built out by whoever the insuring entity is. So in this conversation, he was giving you his opinion about how those public improvement bonds should be handled. And he says, yeah, he was. Well, this is all normal conversation. This is no surprise, but I get the feeling from the guy asking the questions here in this grand jury, they didn't quite, he's trying to figure out, is there something nefarious going on with this? And I'm looking at it, reading this as a counselor, saying, oh, this is all perfectly normal. Yes, so far everything is exactly as it should be. And it doesn't matter if somebody who wants to buy that development is pushing for the law to be followed or the standards to be followed. But the guy asking the question is trying to make it sound otherwise. So, all right, we're going to get a little bit more of this when we get back. This is Russ Betts with Councilman Joe McKee here on the Russ Betts Show on iHub Radio in beautiful downtown Palm Springs.
Read about it tomorrow. See it tonight. Hear it all day today. If it's happening in the Coachella Valley, it's front and center now on iHub Radio.
And there it is.
Now, here's Russ Betts.
Wow, these depositions are just darn interesting to go through. It's pages and pages. You can gobble up a lot of time going through this. We're covering some of this in the grand jury transcripts that were recently released in the case with Mayor Steve Pernier, and digging into the testimony of Paul Lewin, who's just there. I mean, these grand juries are interviewing a lot of people, and these depositions go on way long, and I just happened to pick out Paul Lewin, former council member of Palm Springs, because it touched on a subject that helps the show explain what goes on in local government. And they were talking about John Westman, a developer who was looking to buy a development that had been stalled to either sit on it for another 10 years like he did the mall or actually develop it. But the question was, as we're going through this transcript, Westman wanted the city to enforce those bonds. Is that right? Lewin is saying yes. I think that's the easiest way to say it. Now, the inference here is that, well, obviously, for somebody who's picking up a development, if the bonds are enforced and the city can go in and the city goes in and puts in those public improvements, streets, curbs, gutters, sidewalks, perimeter landscaping, etc., well, then the person who goes and buys it doesn't have to do that stuff. And I think the grand jury guy is trying to make the case of, oh, well, look, somebody's trying to get some undue influence. Well, in the other part of this testimony, you'll see where the guy who was defunct on the property and had taken out these bonds was making the case and pressing the city council, saying, oh, no, don't call in these bonds. Certainly for his personal interest, it's a bad thing when you're a developer to have these bonds called in.
Because any future bonds that you tried to get would be priced in a completely different way.
Yeah, and the way it goes is when somebody's going to put in a development like this, they say, hi, I'm going to put this in. We say, great. And he says, the city will tell them, we want you to put in these public improvements. The developer says, oh, okay, no problem. I'll do that. I say, well, it's not that simple. We want an insurance policy. We want bonds. We have something in our hand that if you don't perform, we call in this policy and we'll go put in those improvements ourselves to make sure they're done so the thing doesn't look a mess. And Paul Lewin explains in this that he went out and looked at it. And it was obvious that this development that was stalled in the middle of a neighborhood that didn't have these things in place was an ugly, blighted eyesore. Mm-hmm. And so to him, it didn't matter, you know, if you're going to lose out or you're going to win out. That's not the question. The proper thing for a city to do is to call in the bonds and take care of those public improvements. And I remember this as it was going on, and I'm thinking, this is a no-brainer. It's just very black and white. This is the process. And the reason you wouldn't want to call them in is you would want to be doing a favor for the guy who's having trouble, saying, oh, you know, it's really hard on a developer to call in those bonds.
There, you have that judgment to make depending on what's going on. It's a different circumstance depending on a lot of macro factors, too. Is it 2008 or is it 2020?
Well, and, you know, the way I come down that one is, the bonds are there just because of 2008. When things take a really bad turn, sorry, that's not my fault that the economy's gone bad. My interest is to look out after the residents and the neighbors and have to look at that ugly construction fence.
And there are cities that reacted exactly as you're talking about. Lots of the desert cities called in the bonds or used that as a hammer to force people to do what they should have done.
And there was one city that didn't.
There were other people, more than one city.
Well, there was one city that I know of very well, Desert Hot Springs, that was so concerned about people having their bonds called that they didn't call them in. And then finally, when the crash came and you had the scare with AIG Insurance Company maybe going belly up, somebody says, oh my God, we better go look at these. We may not have anything that's worth any paper at all. And when it turned out—
Which is part of the problem, too, in a real crisis like that. And I can remember the discussion. There was a discussion about whether the bonds were even worth anything in that circumstance because the insurance company might be not be able to pay off because of all the ones that have been paid off.
Well, this all predates your time on the council when these all took place. You came in after the fact on this, but I'm sitting there hammering, call these things in. It's the right thing to do, taking the same position that Paul Lewin did. And we had a former city manager that was very reluctant to do that, wouldn't call him in. And when it finally the scare came, they went and looked at him, and they found out that 11 out of 13 had expired. They were no longer valid. And nobody was watching them, and you had council members sit there who didn't have any slightest understanding of the way these things worked. And the damage is that you got people in a development who are looking at a construction fence for years instead of looking at a block wall landscape as it's supposed to be. And then the other the problem is somebody comes in and wants to restart that stalled development now that the economy's good. If all they have to do is go in and put in the home pads and build on the pads, Well, it's a little easier to get started, but
it's easier and definitely less expensive.
Okay, but if you go look at a development, and I've had them ask me, say, "Oh, well, the city have bonds on this development." I said, "No, they let them expire." So, oh my God, now I got to factor into the price of the house, the cost to pave the road, put in the sidewalks, do the landscaping, the perimeter walls, all that other public improvements. I now got to build those into the price of the house. Now the house is more expensive; it exceeds what the market's willing to pay right now. So we're going to wait. And so your development goes slow. So it's always in the public's interest. And back to this deposition, what I get out of this is Paul Lewin is making the case that this is the right thing to do, but a prosecutor or a grand jury guy trying to find anything wrong, I think they got the wrong take on this one. They something that was perfectly normal and proper, they're trying to make hay out of it.
Well, if city council people get a little confused in this circumstance, I would assume someone that doesn't deal with this at all would be searching around for something that was wrong.
Well, Paul Lewin did a good job of educating him.
Again, it's interesting to me that Paul was in a position he would answer the way he did, because in a lot of ways, you're taking a real chance.
Well, he was being honest. It was just very clear and very correct. So anyhow, all right, well, that's enough of that one, but we decided to cover it since they put it out there. This is Russ Betts on iHub Radio, back with more.
The conversation of your life. Local, relevant, digital, and always on.
America will hear my two cents.
Elected to serve iHub radio listeners across the desert cities. He calls it as he sees it.
Quick question.
Now, here's Russ Betts.
Someone answer him now!
Well, it's been a lively conversation here for the past hour and a half here on the Russ Betts Show, coming to you live every Sunday morning from 8 a.m. till 10 a.m. I've been real happy to have as a co-host, guest host, whatever you want to call him.
Just Joe's fine.
All right. Well, we're changing the marquee on the front of the building. You know, the big thing that's emblazoned with the Russ Betts Show. We have that on the front of the building, you know.
Are we changing the neon? Is that what you're saying?
We're going to add in the Russ and Joe Show, because you've been here helping guest host here. And, you know, obviously you've got some things on your mind. Is there anything that...
Well, let's extend the talk about bonds to something more concrete that we know a little bit about. We've had some issues with the paving job that was done in Desert Hot Springs.
Oh my God, we heard about that one, didn't we?
Heard about it.
You're not on the council anymore. I get to hear about it.
I drive on it. That's all that's going on.
Well, for our listeners, why don't you describe what the condition of that road is?
We basically were in a position where we were doing street upgrades where we were adding lights, meaning signal lights, and also illumination systems. But we were also redoing the pavement on Palm Drive.
A gazillion new street lights, which is illumination systems.
Which is the main street in Desert Hot Springs and has a massive amount of traffic. The project was needed too, so this is a positive thing. The problem is the contractor came in and for whatever reason, I don't know a lot of the technical details, did what could be described as a pretty bad job.
I would use the word horrible job. Bumpy.
Bumpy, lots of seams in it that don't match up. It looked like someone did it that had not paved before.
You want me to give you the technical detail real quickly here? Let me give you the analogy. Imagine you're going to pour a concrete floor in your garage. And instead of using the screed and everything the proper way to do it, you're trying to smooth it with a trowel.
Yes.
They used the wrong equipment. So go ahead.
Okay. So it ends up being a bad job. What recourse do you have? And again, there are performance bonds that are put in place for this. So why don't you talk about the discussion that's taken place and what the result is going to hopefully be.
Okay, well, so what happened, as you described, is a contractor did a horrible job on this with the wrong equipment. He wasn't using parking lot paving equipment instead of the proper equipment. Anyhow, why that got like that, I don't know, but the public has been screaming about this, rightly so, because, well, just as you said.
There's actually been some feedback on this?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, we have some resident experts in paving. One guy who's been running the piece of equipment that puts down the blacktop on Caltrans jobs for 30 years. Great resource. It gives you a lot of information.
Well, how would that person know anything?
Yeah. So anyhow, well, hey, I listened to him. You know, you ran factories, I ran factories, and I bet you the best information you got was from the guy on the line, right?
You listened to everyone.
He didn't know everything, but he was a darn expert on everything passing through his hands, right?
That is true.
Yeah. So anyhow, I listened. But the point was is that this had this very bumpy job done, and now the city had to go through and figure out what to do. And everybody, of course, gets on social media and says, oh, how much is this going to cost? Who's going to get fired over this? And the basic misunderstanding of how the process works, as you mentioned, there were bonds. And the bonds are in place to ensure that if the job didn't get done properly, well, the city is going to go in and exercise this bond and performance bond and get it done properly.
And there's an interesting addendum to this as far as I'm concerned, and that is, how in the world was the paving job allowed to continue? We saw when the first lane was completed that there were issues. There were issues with smoothness. There were issues with rough areas that had not been paved properly. And, you know, what's the circumstance there?
Well, we had earlier warning than that, because the equipment that was staged for the job site, this guy who runs the equipment said, hey, they're using a Model X T1 paver, which is a parking lot paver, and they're not bringing
Let's say.
Right, but here, get your question.
At this point. Let's say the city at that point went to the guy that was doing the paving and he said, oh, no, it's going to be okay. I can use this piece of equipment.
That's exactly what happened. That's right. And now the first lane gets done and it's horrible.
So what should happen? Well, you should stop them at that point.
So the question is, who was the inspector on the job?
Exactly.
And the inspector on the job obviously didn't do his job, because you and I know that if you see sign of trouble, you don't just keep producing all day with bad product. You stop and say, hey, there's a problem here. And part of it was the paving job was done on a extended vacation at the Christmas to New Year's break.
Oh, boy.
Okay, so there wasn't anybody to stop anything. But basically it comes down to an inspector who was paid to do that didn't do it. And, you know, I'm sure that...
So is this a person that is a consultant, or is it a person that works for the city?
No, it's a company that's hired. I think the name is
Omnis. So is the city going to do anything about that?
So, yeah, the cut to the chase is, now what's going to happen is the city negotiates with the paving company who got the contract and says...
Oh, no, I'm talking about the inspection company.
Well, I don't think that inspector who missed that and a prior similar situation, and this is actually the third time this has happened in the city, and twice with the same inspector. So I think that inspector probably is, you know, not going to be inspecting any more streets in Desert Hot Springs. I got to be careful. I don't want to get any liability issues. I'm not going to name anybody.
Well, I wouldn't expect you to.
But I think it's obvious there was a failing on the inspection job, because it should have been stopped right away.
We see the same sort of thing happening in a lot of the paving jobs that were done a few years ago, too. That you know, it's my feeling that either the thickness wasn't right or there were some other things going on.
Yeah, well, that's a whole other subject.
But anyway, so let's not go there. Let's go back to this specific
project. We'll go to that
one
next week if you want. So the issue was that, so what's going to happen is now a reputable paving company, Matage, is going to come in and they're going to do a grind, and then they're going to overlay a smooth surface with an operator that knows how to run the equipment properly. Now, our resident expert, guy who's been laying down blacktop for 30 years, who's watching this and telling us what he's opinion, and he says, whoever's going to be running that machine is going to have a tough job putting down 1 inch over that surface, and the grind better be very, very good, or you're going to end up with the same thing.
Yeah.
And the city's option is, we got a bond, we can make them tear it all out and put it all back in again.
We've done before.
Yeah, but we've got an engineer's report from a qualified engineering company that says, here's our recommendation, and we recommend you grind to this level. We've measured 1 inch will cover it. Do a proper grind job. The blacktop itself was fine. The integrity is good. The core samples showed good. But there's what we're recommending. So if we go to court saying we want to exercise this bond, we're going to be in court for a while. We have an expert, you know, engineer's report that says, well, this is what you should do. And we're saying, well, we want to do more. And the judge is going to say, you know what? No, we're not going to do that. So, you know, the insurance company is going to balk at the claim. So what got worked out was the original successful bidder, the person who got the job, is going to pay for another company to come in and do it right. So within another couple, 3 weeks, 2 weeks, I hope. I don't know how long does it take. I didn't get
probably
the schedule
the next shutdown of the city government.
Probably, yeah. Well, I don't know. You're turned into a cynic since you got on. Well, you weren't a cheerleader for City Hall when you were on the council either, were you?
No, it's part of the job of a city council person to be a check on City Hall.
I don't think people that work in City Hall, the staff, understand that concept. I keep telling them, I'm not City Hall. I'm the liaison between City Hall and the people that hired me, the voters. And that's our job. And I know you looked at it that way too. And there's times when the public is wrong and you got to defend city staff. And there's times when...
Absolutely. But that's not the point. The point is that we are not in a position that our job is to defend the city staff. It is to make sure that we're as efficient as possible as a city, that the right thing.
If they're correct... If somebody's sitting there saying somebody should be fired because they didn't put in the proper protections, we're going to get stuck with this bill, and the city isn't going to get stuck with the bill, I'm going to say, hey, you know what? You got that detail wrong. This will be fixed. It was a mistake to begin with, but the proper protections were in place. What would have been a big problem is if there wasn't a bond in place. And that was the first question I asked is, do you have the proper guarantees in there that if they don't do a job right, that we got an insurance policy to let us do it right? Mm-hmm. And that was there. So staff did a good job on that. Okay.
So, anyway, so
that's you know, this is any street anywhere, and I heard from our resident expert that a few other cities around the Coachella Valley haven't done a great job. So I guess if you've been running a paver for 30 years, you know when a job's done perfect.
Well, and you know as a driver when their job's done imperfectly.
I think that's what city staff forgets is that every one of us that drive down a road are experts, just like that guy on the line who sees all those parts passing his hand and can tell you how good the quality is. When we drive down a road, we know if something's right or not. And to sit there and tell everybody, oh, there's no problem when your coffee is splashing out of your coffee cup.
Was the initial reaction was that there was no problem?
Well, there was a little bit of denial going on. You know, you're starting to get me in. You don't have to deal with these ramifications. So if anybody's listening to the conversation, or city staff is going to be upset at me now because... Yeah, they were in denial. I'll say it. That's true. You know, it's tough being a city council member. It's not as easy as you think. You got to walk in that office and say, hi, guys, you messed up.
If you're in a position that people, they drive in too. Most of the people that are in the staff don't live in Desert Hot Springs.
I couldn't understand how they
drove
across.
They drive that road every day.
And you ask me, how could you drive that road and not realize there was a big, giant problem before all the rest of the paving got done? That's what I want to know.
Well, they weren't driving in at that time, though.
I guess that's the saving grace there, is that they were on vacation.
That's another whole question.
Let me ask you, would you schedule a major factory upgrade while you were on vacation?
No.
No, I wouldn't either. So, all right. Well, anyhow, what else is out there that we can talk about besides this stuff getting me in trouble? You know, we got...
Let's talk a little bit about spending in politics, and specifically... You know, I brought in a bunch of crap for you to look at from the last presidential primary that we just had. And what intrigues me is the fact that we had somebody spending a huge pile of money, and I won't name who it is, except it was Bloomberg. And
I got those mailers in my mailbox, 2 and 3 a day.
What intrigues me is historically there are some states that would be successful in. You can look at the fact that people can spend money and it's successful. One of the things that intrigues me is the fact that historically California has not been one of those states, that we've had several elections where a person has really outspent their opponent.
Meg Whitman.
That is a good example, that have been really unsuccessful in dealing with, in trying to win.
I thought it was a bit of overkill when I go to my mailbox. I got four
one day.
I had 4 pieces of mail, and 3 of them were from Bloomberg.
Yeah, I got 4 of them in one day.
And when you're on a city council running and paying for this stuff, you realize how expensive that is.
You know, what, in our city, probably between $3,500 and $5,000
a mailing.
For a mailer.
Yeah.
imagine doing that to all the Democrats in the whole state.
Well, he has $60 billion, so I guess he just figured,
well,
what the heck.
Well, there's no doubt that it didn't even hurt, but yeah, that's another matter.
Maybe I'll go hit him up for a campaign contribution, do my mailers for me. No,
well,
no.
Well, he does support down ballot stuff.
Well, we'll find out. All right, this is Russ Betts and Joe McKee on the Russ Betts Show here on iHeartRadio. We're back with more from beautiful downtown Palm Springs, California.
Live from the Palm Springs iHub, he calls it as he sees it. The Russ Betts Show. Call 760-544-TALK. Now, here's Russ Betts.
All right, well, it was a whirlwind of a week. Some big developments going on up in Southern California Association of Governments. I'm looking at an article here from the Signal Tribune, which must be up in Long Beach way. Talking about this big vote at the Southern California Association of Governments on basically trying to solve the housing crisis in California. And in an...
Gee, I wonder how that's going to work.
Well, it worked out well as far as I was concerned, because you had Orange County trying to push off a whole bunch of stuff that they don't want on a bunch of cities in huge numbers.
Yes.
Like, for example, Desert Hot Springs has 7,500 homes. And the suggestion was that by Orange County was that we build 9,700 low and moderate income homes, because they didn't want to build any. And so anyhow, it was the result was good. It gets to be almost too complicated to talk about. It's hard. I spent 18 months in subcommittee meetings and meetings on this and digging into methodologies and basically the government.
And you had to get into detail. I spent 5 years on it when I was on the committee you're on now.
Yeah, so, and I was doing it for 2 or 3 years before you got on there. So
right. So I just want to say something positive. I don't usually compliment you too much, because if you don't need it, you compliment yourself most of the time. But this is something that I think that especially the citizens of the smaller, poorer communities need to clap on the back people like Russ, who are on these committees, because historically this process has been run and modified by areas that basically try and push responsibility off onto other people. And look at things from the standpoint of San Francisco, Los Angeles, and San Diego, rather than smaller, poorer communities that don't have as much political power. And I think this was an effort that a lot of us put forth in these committees for a long time, because we saw the inequity and the problems with the fact that you cannot solve a lot of our problems by building low-income housing in specific communities rather than spreading them around. And more than that, you have to build entry-level, poor, low-income housing in the communities in which jobs exist.
And we're not talking projects either. We're talking, moderate homes like Desert Hot Springs.
Yes.
And what you had was Orange County for decades, or a decade or more, saying, we're the powerhouse, we got the votes, and we're linking up with Los Angeles.
Yes.
And we're just going to shove all this off onto you. And that's how we got some astronomical numbers, a requirement to build more low-income homes in our city than we actually had in our city.
And the classic example for me is from the last requirement that the state put forward, Beverly Hills was in compliance with their requirements as far as housing was concerned. And Desert Hot Springs, which in the last few years I was there, only built housing that was defined as low-income housing. Every house that was built fit that definition was not.
Yeah.
And you know that there's really a problem when you have that occurring.
Yeah, well, anyhow, it gets way more complicated, because people try and get their head wrapped around this, thinking that, why don't you want to build low-income housing in your city? Hey, we got more than enough. Our number is still, I think, 3,000.
Oh, it's more than that. I think probably 80% of the housing in Desert Hot Springs is defined as low-income
housing. I know, but the requirement out of the state to build more was about 3,000 in a city with about 7,000 to 9,000 homes, 7,500 homes.
Yes.
So, and boy, poor
Coachella. I know that some people are now at this point falling asleep sort of about this, but the important thing is this. If you force poorer communities to build all the low-income housing, they're not in a position that they can provide the services that are necessary for that housing. Housing below a certain dollar amount does not pay for itself as far as services are concerned.
Yeah.
So it affects your fire department, it affects your police department, it affects your library and parks and everything that you can think of. And really, it affects also your school district.
And it affects the people that have to drive 2 and 3 hours to go to a job.
Which is one of the things.
And then back home to a house that they can afford, which is 2 or 3 hours away through all this LA traffic.
Which is one of the things that is not discussed as far as synergy is concerned, because if you have goals that are environmental, you know, that you're trying to meet, if you're building your housing in this way, where your housing is way away from jobs,
urban sprawl, suburban sprawl,
you're not going to be able to meet those environmental goals too.
Well, Joe, instead of me having to get into the shameless self-promotion, appreciate the compliment. Thank you. It was a tough fight, but you were there too.
I'm appreciative that you, at the end, took the ball and got it over the goal line.
And, you know, it wasn't just me. There's a lot of people working this, but,
exactly.
You know, I mean, it was a good, intense effort. And, you know, it's this big, huge boulder, like I put it. You're trying to stop it from rolling over you, and you finally get it pushed, stopped, and then actually puffed back the other way.
Exactly.
And so that was good. And anyhow, it's a good article in the Signal Tribune in Long Beach if you want to get some of the details. It's a little bit from an Orange County perspective because the reporter didn't actually call us to get our views, but it's a good article. We got way more than we could possibly cover. We could actually go to another hour on the show, but, you know, I'll be happy to get out here and get home and do my Sunday.
Donuts are waiting for me.
Somewhere, yeah. Oh, they're waiting for you? Yeah, I'm going to watch the donuts. I had a little too much Christmas holiday. I'm trying to shed some of that.
I am too, but it's Sunday.
I really wish I had time to get into this. CalPERS retiree gets the largest pension payment ever. Guess how much he's making a month?
We've got a couple minutes. Go ahead.
Guess how much this guy's making a month on retirement? $34,800 a month retirement.
How could you live on that?
I don't know how some. What do? You go buy a new car? I could go buy a brand new $38,000 car this month and say, hey, you know what? Next month I got $38,000 coming in. I'll be okay. Right? There's something seriously wrong. Well, it's going to crash. We've
talked about this before, but we can do it again because I think it's really important for people to understand. And it's important for people that are involved in the program itself. If I were a retiree in the CalPERS program, I myself would be really worried about the circumstances.
Well, if you can hear the pages ruffling here, I'm looking at the list of retirees. And it's the first page, there's 15 people, and here's a guy making $363,000 a year in retirement, and the lowest guy on this first page is making $285,000 a year in retirement. Then I go to the next page, which has got 15 people, and we're still in the $258,000 range. And then I go down to the next page, $248,000, and that's only three pages of the printout. There's thousands of people making $25,000-$30,000 a month in retirement, and then we're all paying for that.
It's not thousands making that much, but there are hundreds for sure.
All right. Next week we'll go through the list and I'll tell you if it's thousands or hundreds. Okay.
Okay, that's good.
But we're out of time now today, Joe.
You're gonna go to what website to do that?
What is it? Transparent.
Transparent California.
I got to get this quick before we run out of time. Transparent California. TransparentCalifornia.com. That's it. Russ Betts, Joe McKee, done. Next week we'll be back.
Maybe.